Our sermon text reading this morning is taken from John chapter 19. After these things, Joseph of Arimathea, who was a disciple of Jesus, but secretly for fear of the Jews, asked Pilate that he might take away the body of Jesus, and Pilate gave him permission. So he came and took away his body. Nicodemus also, who earlier had come to Jesus by night, came bringing a mixture of myrrh and aloes, about 75 pounds in weight. So they took the body of Jesus and bound it in linen cloths with the spices, as is the burial custom of the Jews. Now in the place where he was crucified, there was a garden, and in the garden a new tomb in which no one had yet been laid. So because of the Jewish day of preparation, since the tomb was close at hand, they laid Jesus there. You may be seated.
So we're in a series on Matthew, and I have John read. Doesn't make any sense at all. Keep your fingers in Matthew chapter 27. Matthew chapter 27, we'll be looking at verses 57 to 66. But there's a reason that we read that John passage. The biggest reason of all is because we're introduced to an additional figure who is on the scene that Matthew chooses not to mention. But I find it to be a little bit interesting and significant. So I wanted to bring your attention to the fact that Nicodemus, along with Joseph of Arimathea, were responsible for placing the body of the dead Lord Jesus in the grave. Joseph of Arimathea is mentioned on all four Gospels. Arimathea is the town from which he came. Arimathea is a town that's not on the coast, but between the coast and the vertical line between the Sea of Galilee and the Dead Sea. And it's about halfway between both of those things. And I hoped to tell you all kinds of brilliant things about the town of Arimathea from which Joseph came. Unfortunately, there's just not a terrible lot of information about the city of Arimathea. Tradition holds that the prophet Samuel was born there and potentially buried near there as well, but that's tradition, and there's no necessarily geographical or historical evidence that proves that fact. But each four of the Gospels want us to know that Joseph is from Arimathea. The Gospels also tell us that Joseph was part of the council. What that means is that he was a member of the Sanhedrin. He was a member of one of the high-ranking Jewish official groups, one of the groups that would have been responsible for the trial of Jesus. John tells us that he was a follower of Jesus, but that his following of Jesus up to this point had been secret because he was afraid of his fellow councilmen. But obviously, in the incident that we'll look at today, his secrecy dissolves. The other figure who is very interesting and fascinating to me is a man named Nicodemus. We're told in the Gospel of Mark that Nicodemus was actually a Pharisee like the Apostle Paul was. Nicodemus had been fascinated by Jesus and apparently had followed Jesus' career. Back in John chapter 3, Nicodemus was the Pharisee who had come to Jesus by night with certain theological and biblical questions. Jesus and Nicodemus had discoursed back and forth on the topic of how is a man born again. Nicodemus was fascinated by the topic, and Jesus expounded on the scriptures like Ezekiel chapter 36 and 37, and Jesus himself turned to Nicodemus and said, "How is it that you, a teacher of the law, don't know these things?" Well, Nicodemus, who had kept his interest in what I believe now is the following of Jesus' secret, also came out, so to speak, into the light. There are really four figures mentioned by name or partially by name in the account we'll look at today. Joseph, Nicodemus is not mentioned in Matthew, but he was the one that showed up with the spices to prepare the body for burial. 75 pounds of spices, a mixed bag in those spices, one of which was myrrh. Myrrh was a tree sap from a particular tree that when it hardened in those globules on the side of the tree, they would scrape off and grind up, and it became a highly prized aromatic perfume along with something that was used for burial. It was also one of the three gifts given to Jesus at his birth when the wise men showed up to honor Mary and Joseph. Both men were men of wealth. Both men were men of position. Both men, in certain ways, were men that had something to lose by identifying themselves with being followers of Jesus. The other two figures are Mary Magdalene and, as Matthew calls her, the other Mary, who were sitting on a bench watching these two poor fellows try to wrap the body of Jesus in what we're told is a new linen cloth surrounded by these oils and ointments and perfumes, and then placing Jesus in the tomb. I won't say a whole lot about the tomb. Our text tells us that it was a new tomb. That doesn't mean that it was just hewn out of the rock that week or some weeks before. It means that it was a tomb that had not been used. So it may well have been a tomb that was 10 or 20 years old that Joseph had acquired some time before. A tomb of its type would have held multiple bodies. There would have been benches along the sides of the cave in which bodies would have been placed as need. But this tomb had never been used before. But it was the type of tomb that would have been costly and expensive. And I mention that only because this incident is a fulfillment of a prophecy in Isaiah chapter 53, verse 9. Let me just read it to you. And this is to say, and they made his grave with the wicked and with a rich man in his death, although he had done no violence and there was no deceit in his mouth. What a tremendous prophecy. A little sidebar, something of fairly small consequence, really, but Jesus was buried in a rich man's tomb that had never been used before. Our text reads, beginning in verse 57, when it was evening, there came a rich man from Arimathea, whose name was Joseph, who was also a disciple of Jesus. And he went to Pilate and asked for the body of Jesus. And then Pilate ordered it to be given to him. A couple of things that were unusual about this. Because of Joseph's position being on the council or the Sanhedrin with the Jews, he would have been one of those few who would have been able to gain an audience with Pilate. So he had access to Roman authority. But the gig was up because he had to do it publicly, and so obviously it was evidence that he was a follower of Jesus, and he asked for the body of Jesus, which was unusual in the sense that criminals who had been crucified were not given any type of honorary burial. They were generally drug outside of town where nature took its course. And so a rich man who came requesting the body of a criminal would have been an unusual thing. It says he was wrapped in a new linen shroud, which is a minor thing to us, but it demonstrates the respect that Joseph was showing to the body of Jesus. He could have used a used linen, a used sheet or a soiled blanket or something like that, which really wouldn't have been offensive, but the text chooses to tell us that Joseph was careful enough that he wanted to purchase a new clean linen as a shroud for Jesus. And all this time, as two wealthy, well-known men, with the equivalent of embalming Jesus' body and preparing it for burial, these two women sat on a stone bench somewhere and watched it all take place. I mean, it's a lonely, tragic, sad, potentially disturbing picture of the end of the King of the Universe, supposedly. Most of us know or have heard many sermons on this text, and there's great detail that's going to be or can be given, and I really don't want to highlight all that detail, but I want to turn our attentions to the second group who are involved in this burial, and that really comes to us in verse 62 to 66. Let me just read those verses over for us and make a few comments. The next day, that is after the day of preparation, that day of preparation that's being referred to is the preparation day for Passover. Keep in mind that all these things are taking place during the Passover celebration. During this time, the chief priests and the Pharisees gathered before Pilate. I could add again. I'm reading between the lines, but I don't know that Pilate was pleased to see this group again with the debacle that had taken place with Barabbas and the public scene of Pilate washing his own hands. But they came before Pilate with these words to say, and they said, "Sir, we remember how that this impostor said while he was still alive," by the way, if there's any question about the death of Jesus, whether he actually died on the cross, even his enemies recognized that he was dead. Because when they came to Pilate, they said, "Well, when he was alive, he said that after 3 days I will rise." And that sentence bears some comment as well. There are those who would want to say that the only person who ever heard Jesus claim that he would rise again from the dead were his disciples and his closest followers. It was very clear and evident, even to his enemies, that this was one of his claims, that he would rise again on the third day. As a matter of fact, they took that claim so seriously, that's the reason that they came to Pilate. This impostor, they called him, claimed that he would rise after 3 days. Therefore, in verse 64, "Please order the tomb to be made secure until the third day, lest his disciples go and steal away the body and tell people and that he is risen from the dead, and the last fraud will be worse than the first." So that's the religious establishment's perspective on the whole thing. Jesus was an imposter. His whole career was a fraud, and we don't want the fraud to be perpetuated. And so we're asking from you a guard for the tomb. Simple story, quite sensible in a lot of ways, if you have those kinds of fears. And Pilate has reason to have those fears as well. Pilate, you know, being the Roman official who oversaw these three executions, even though he had washed his hands of the whole thing and declared that Jesus was innocent, you know, doesn't want empty graves for criminals. That looks bad on a public official's record. I mean, his reasons are different. The Pharisees and the Sadducees, of course, if Jesus' tomb ends up empty, they have a tremendous amount of things to explain. I mean, they can point fingers at the disciples and say they've stolen his body, but there's still that opportunity for doubt and concern. And so in verse 65 and 66, it says this, "Pilate said to them, 'You have a guard of soldiers. go make it secure as you can. And so they went and made the tomb secure by sealing the stone and setting a guard. That's the last two verses that we'll spend most of our time on here in a minute. Some of us in the room, and I'm not going to say a whole lot here about these soldiers, but some of us have been to Arlington Cemetery. And some of us have seen the changing of the guard. When I was there, it was toward the end of the Vietnam War, and I was in junior high, and I watched the changing of the guards, and there was a military funeral taking place at the same time. I've been to dozens of military funerals in my life, but this one was particularly poignant. I've also watched videos of the changing of the guard, and it's disturbing, but it bears watching. I've seen a video where an observant, a person who was watching the change of the guard was out of line, was making too much noise, and I saw the guard step out of rank and approach that person and dress them down in a way that humbled the person beyond compare. I say all of this is because military individuals who are placed on duty take it very, very, very seriously. I've heard the interviews of some of the men who have walked that post before the Tomb of the Unknown, and they consider it the highlight of their career, that it is the greatest honor that they could possibly have while in uniform. These guards are not dissimilar. They're not there to guard the corpse. They're not there to give the dead honor. They're there to protect it from being stolen. There may have been as many as 30 guards shifting off in different shifts throughout the night and throughout the day. The penalty for failing to do their duty was death. Most of us know this. Were they to even fall asleep while on post, it meant death to them. But the thing that I want to draw our attention to is this funny little thing that may not have drawn your attention before. It says in verse 66, though they went and made the tomb secure by sealing the stone and setting a guard. The grave was sealed in two ways. The stone, more likely than not, the historians tell me in my reading, that the stone may have weighed upwards of 4,000 pounds. There were two ways in which graves like this were closed, but when they say the stone rolled, it was likely that it was a round stone that had a trench in front of it, and the stone was rolled in place in front of the opening of the grave. That would have been one part of the sealing, but the second part that is mentioned here is a Roman seal was placed on the outside of the stone. Some sort, and I can't paint you a picture accurately, of some big wax glob that would have been between the stone that was on the outside and the wall of the tomb there, and it would have been sealed with some sort of signet ring that would have symbolized the Roman Empire. And when that seal was in place, it meant it had the seal of the entirety of the Roman Empire, and to break that seal, regardless of who you were, if you were not the emperor himself, was punishable by death. And the soldiers took that very, very seriously. It took an ordinary duty, an ordinary assignment, and raised the bar dramatically. Very, very dramatically. Like a soldier, instead of merely walking a post in front of his base, to taking that soldier and putting him in front of the Tomb of the Unknown. A real raised bar. But what's fascinating is it's not the only place in the Bible where a seal is placed on a stone. It's not. And it's fascinating that it is in the book of Daniel. Daniel chapter 6. And I want to give you the context of Daniel, but before I do, I just want to say this. Daniel is a very important book to Matthew. Daniel quotes and alludes to Daniel many, 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 many times throughout the Gospel of Matthew. So it shouldn't be surprising that we find ourselves in Daniel chapter 6. Let me just give you the context. If you have been in Sunday school, no doubt you know the generalities of the story. But here it is. Daniel, along with many, many others, is an exile and a prisoner of the Persian Empire. And the king of Persia is a man named Darius. And Daniel has grown to be seen with favor by the king, King Darius. And so he's been put into a political position. And not surprisingly, the Persian politicians who have the same rank, if you will, as Daniel are jealous of Daniel because he does his job better than they do, and he's a foreigner. But I want you to remember that word jealousy. Do you remember back to Jesus' trial when Pilate and the high priest is standing before him, and Matthew tells us that Pilate discerned that the reason that they were bringing Jesus before him was because of jealousy? Well, anyways, Daniel has the favor of King Darius, and the other guys are jealous of this, so they devise a plan. Darius had an ego, and so, my goodness, we have something going on. So Darius had an ego, and so they proposed that there should be a national holiday that lasted 30 days, and during that 30 days, nobody should worship or honor anything or anyone but King Darius. And if they did, we need to bring that down just a bit, Taylor, or something. I'll give it a minute here, folks. You let me work. Thumbs up, back to normal. Great. If anybody did, they would be killed. So that's the context. Darius liked the idea so well that he ordered it into law, and he swore that it would be under the law of the Medes and the Persians. Ever heard that phrase? The Medes and the Persians, I swear, were like the Medes and the Persians. I'm old enough, I guess, to know it. But the law of the Medes and the Persians means that it cannot be changed, altered, or broken by anything, anyone, under any set of circumstances. Now, Darius, at the time this all took place, was the most powerful man in the world. We need to understand that. When he was king of Persia, he was the most powerful man in the world, like during Jesus' day, the Roman Empire was the most powerful power in the world as well. Well, the other guys who are jealous of Daniel find him praying, rat him out to Darius. Darius knows that he's been caught in a trap. He tries to figure out how to get Daniel out of it, but he can't because the law has been placed under the law of the Medes and the Persians. And so he orders Daniel thrown into the lion's den. And let me look at verse 17 of Daniel chapter 6. And a stone was brought and laid on the mouth of the den, and the king sealed it with his own signet and with the signet of his lords, and nothing might be changed concerning Daniel. Now, I'm not trying to get over spiritual. I'm not trying to make mountains out of molehills. Some similarities are hard to miss, though. You know, a stone over what must be a grave for Daniel, a wax seal that is sealed by the king himself, which cannot be broken under penalty of death by anyone anywhere. The king spends all night awake because he's afraid for his friend Daniel. He goes early in the morning. Daniel's awake and alive. He's thrilled beyond measure. He takes the duplicitous politicians, throws them into the lions, at which all little boys, 6 and 7 in Sunday school, cheer. And Daniel is set free. Now, the story in Sunday school ends there. But the story from Matthew and Daniel does not. Because after all this takes place, Darius, the all-powerful king of all the world, and I'm not making this up, makes a pronouncement. And his pronouncement is in verses 25 to 28 of Daniel 6. And this is what he says. Then King Darius wrote to all the peoples, nations, and languages that dwell in all the earth. Peace be multiplied to you is his salutation to them. I make a decree that in all my royal dominion, people are to tremble and fear before the God of Daniel, for he is the living God, enduring forever. His kingdom shall never be destroyed, and his dominion shall have no end. For he delivers and he rescues. He works signs and wonders in heaven and on earth, and he has saved Daniel from the power of the lions. So here's Darius's proclamation. Daniel has a God that I want the whole world to worship. And this God has a kingdom that is never going to end and cannot be destroyed. And his kingdom is universal. Okay? And Darius, the most powerful man in the world, says, this is the God that needs to be served. Okay, God's kingdom. Now, if you're in Daniel, flip over to Daniel chapter 7. Just a couple of verses. Don't get caught up by 6 and 7 and all that other stuff because they weren't in the original. The story is just continuing. Daniel has the next vision. Daniel has lots of visions. Let me read from verse 15, just a couple of verses. As for me, Daniel, my spirit within me was anxious and the visions in my head. Wait a minute, I'm reading the wrong verse, verse 13. Sorry about that, I got too excited. I saw in the night visions, and behold, with the clouds of heaven there came one like the Son of Man. And he came to the Ancient of Days. That's saying he came to God. You wouldn't say God because in Hebrew you don't want to take God's name in vain. The Son of Man came before God, all right, and he was presented to him, and to him, verse 14, was given dominion and glory and a kingdom that all the peoples, nations, and languages would serve him. His dominion is everlasting, and it will not pass away, and his kingdom one that shall never be destroyed. Hang with me, friends. I promise this is going great. Darius says there's a God and he has a kingdom. Daniel has a vision and says God has a kingdom. I want to introduce you to the king. He is one who is like the Son of Man. And he is going to reign on God's kingdom forever and ever. It cannot be destroyed and it will never have an end. Got the picture? See how the context, little wax seal, all this stuff is going on. Now, back to Matthew, but not Matthew 27 just yet. Matthew chapter 24. Just a couple of weeks ago, Matthew chapter 24, this is really exciting stuff. I promise, bear with me, it's worth your time and effort. Jesus is talking to his disciples about his return. His return at the end of time, his second coming, after his death and after his resurrection, when he comes back to justify the entire universe and bring everybody under judgment and so on and so forth, this is what he has to say in verse 30. Then will appear in heaven the sign of the Son of Man. Now, how was Jesus referred to in Daniel? The Son of Man. Jesus, in the Gospel of Matthew, calls himself the Son of Man all the time. And he's picking up on Daniel's language because he wants people to begin to understand he's the king Daniel was talking about over God's kingdom. in heaven in the sight of the Son of Man, and then all the tribes of the earth will mourn, and they will see the Son of Man coming on the clouds of heaven with power and great glory. And he will send out his angels with a loud trumpet call, and they will gather all the elect from the four winds, from the heavens, from the end of the earth. He's saying at the end of time, the Son of Man is going to show up, and this is when the judgment is going to begin, and so on and so forth. But in chapter 26, we're almost done. Chapter 26, verse 64, this is only 12 hours before the death of Jesus. In chapter 26 of Matthew, and we get to verse 64, Jesus is on the first part of his trial, and he's before the religious people, okay? He's before the chief priests and the Pharisees, and they ask Jesus one question at the end of 63. I adjure you by the living God, tell us if you are the Christ, the Son of God. And Jesus said to him, you have said it, but I tell you from now on, you will see the Son of Man seated at the right hand of power and coming on the clouds of heaven. He quotes Daniel chapter 7. So this whole business about Jesus being sealed in a tomb and Jesus calling himself the Son of Man, and Jesus is returning as the Son of Man, and the kingdom being given to him is all the way throughout. And this sealing of the tomb is to remind us of Daniel and the pronouncement about the kingdom by Darius and Daniel's announcement of who the king is. Jesus throughout the gospel is claiming to be the king of the eternal kingdom in the book of Daniel all the way along, and you will see next week in chapter 28, he puts the icing on the cake when he says, all authority in heaven and on earth has been given to me. He claims the rightful authority of the King of God's kingdom in that moment by quoting Daniel once again. Okay, so what's the point? Wonderful coincidence, if they're coincidence. Hard-pressed to pull that off, but what's the point and what's the application? You look at this from the outside, you got two weeping women over here, two rich guys embalming a guy and putting him in a new grave, and the grave is sealed. And from a human perspective, the story's over and the book is closed. I mean, let's face it, there is no other place to go. The two most powerful people or entities in the world have put their seal on Daniel's grave and put their seal on Jesus' grave. Surely nothing's going to change that. And the application today is very similar to last week, but with a couple of different twists. Darius, amazingly, realized that there was a God in heaven and a kingdom that was going to last forever and ever, that could not be destroyed. His kingdom came and went. His power dwindled. The Roman Empire, not much is said about them anymore. The rise and fall, and they fell further than they rose. But we live in a time and a place where, humanly speaking, and rightfully so, we look around at circumstances, and it looks like the grave is closed and the wax seal is on, and there is nothing we can do about it. And it looks hopeless and absolutely dismal. And if our perspective is only horizontal, we're right. And quite honestly, despair is the right response. unless the Son of Man is the Son of God, who is the King over God's eternal kingdom, who has promised to return. In which case, our attention should be forward, saying, bring it on. Come back. Come back now. Come back now. If there's any hope, that's the hope. And of course, the empty grave that we look at tomorrow is the assurance of that hope. Let me pray. Father in heaven, we thank you for your word, the Bible, and the fact that it's true. And I pray that your risen Son would help us focus rightly on the King who reigns over a kingdom that was promised before all time. That we would not despair at looking at the circumstances of our day, our hour, our month, or our year, for the King reigns. And it is in his name we pray. Amen.